In the spring of 1939, Nazi Germany occupied the Czech Republic, Bohemia and Moravia, while Slovakia became a puppet fascist state. Some 500 Jews were living in the town of Pardubice in the 1930s. Two of them were Chaim and Ella Werner. Chaim was a traveling salesman. Ella stayed home and took care of their two children, Pavel and Ella. In March 1939, Nazi Germany occupied Bohemia. Jews were fired from their jobs. Jewish children were thrown out of school. Then they were forced out of their homes. Bank accounts were confiscated. And once the Austrian barracks town of Theresienstadt, or Terezin, had been turned into a ghetto in late 1941, the deportations began. The Werners were called to a transport on the 3rd of November, 1942. And that is where the Werners spent 2 years, living in an overcrowded ghetto with tens of thousands of others. Pavel's sister Lenka, 9 years old, died of tuberculosis in early 1944, and then came the transports to what they were told would be the East. That meant Auschwitz. Pavel Werner's story is read for us by Elliot Levy in London.
We arrived in Auschwitz at night. I can still see it before my eyes. There were lights everywhere. There were electrical wire fences everywhere that separated the individual camps. The prisoners from the commando unit that was pulling us off the train were bellowing. The Germans were bellowing. A person felt like he'd landed in a different world, and soon each of us had their arms tattooed with a number.
But instead of shaving their heads and dividing the prisoners up, the entire transport from Terezin was brought to a section of Birkenau, which would be known as the Czech family camp. Not many people know about it. Even historians have difficulty explaining it. But for 6 months, the residents of the Czech family camp, which in time took in a few Jewish prisoners from other countries, functioned in ways the rest of Birkenau did not.
There was a special Kinderblock for children in the family camp, so they could learn and study. But because I was tall and looked older, I was only 12 when we arrived. I was sent to live with my father instead. I couldn't attend classes in Kinderblock schools, so I would sit and do maths homework on every piece of paper I could find. I didn't want to fall behind. I can say this. To be in Auschwitz-Birkenau was to suffer unimaginable cruelty on every level. I remember the shouting. Our Lager Capo, the former executioner from Theresien, a man by the name of Fischer, was always on a rampage. He was hideous, inside and out. My father was getting worse by the day, both physically and mentally. This Fischer would just walk up to him and beat him from time to time. Living in the family camp, we saw the flames and the smoke from the crematoria in Birkenau. We smelled the stench of burning corpses. But in the beginning, I didn't perceive it as a mortal danger. You see, I was just a child. I didn't grasp that in the end, I could one day end up there, and besides, children have their own reality. But for my parents, it must have been a horror. The knowledge that next time it could be our turn. Because later we learned there had been an earlier transport from Theresien. They had lived in this family camp for 6 months, then suddenly they were all sent to the gas chamber, every one of them. My parents knew about this. They were waiting to see what would happen to us. We were told to write postcards home to relatives to say we were all right. Then we were called up for a selection. As for the men and boys, we all stood naked in a horribly long queue in front of Dr. Mengele, who organised it all. I know that a great many people say they stood in front of Mengele, but in this case it has been verified. He did the selection of the Czechs. Standing with my father, I went first. Mengele looked at me. He didn't say anything. The prisoner that was sitting beside him just wrote down the tattooed number on my arm. Mengele motioned that I should go to one side. The side that I was on, there were very few of us. We were all young boys. The other side was already quite full. Older men. My father told them in German that he'd like to go to that side because his son was there. Mengele told him, "You won't be together anyway." My group joined up with another group, so altogether there were about 90 young boys and we were relocated to Camp D, the so-called men's camp. I didn't know it then, but we, these 90 boys, would become known as the Birkenau boys. The next day we found out that across Camp C, across the wires, you could see into Camp B. All of us boys rushed up to the wires, but not too close because they were electrified, so we could look for our parents. And I saw my parents. I recognised them by their silhouettes. We began waving at each other. Then we had to leave. The next day we came back to the wire and again we saw each other. We waved frantically. And the third day, they weren't there. Up until the end of the war, I wasn't convinced that my parents had been murdered. A person held out hope. And all the boys really hoped that when they returned home, our parents would be there waiting. In January 1945, we could hear Soviet artillery. And those German idiots dragged the whole camp, all of Auschwitz-Birkenau, westward. So in January 1945, they chased us out on a death march. It was just in time for my 13th birthday. It's a major miracle that in the end, most of us boys survived. Especially because it was after Auschwitz that things got even worse, if you can believe it. From January up to liberation in May 1945, we were on one death march after another. The only good thing was that that horrible man, Fischer, he was on the death march with us. But along the way, he fell behind. They shot him. We plodded on foot to Mauthausen, to Melk, then back again to Mauthausen, to Gunskirchen. The cold. The marching. The starvation. I learned that death doesn't happen when a person just falls down and drops dead. No, it was worse than that. And I watched death approaching those around me. You see, first you lose your appetite. You no longer have even the desire to eat. You're barely functioning at this point. You're just moving around in some mechanical way. A person's eyes sink in. His face gets this almost black skin colour. He doesn't speak. He simply winds down. In 2 or 3 days, he drops, without even knowing it. And it's over. On the 4th of May, 1945, the Americans liberated us in Gunskirchen. They threw away our filthy clothes, but the only clothes they had to give us were German uniforms, but without any insignia. They fed us and gave us medical attention, then sent us on our way. 3 of us boys set out on foot for Bratislava. It was June 1945, horribly hot. We were extremely weak, and we walked only at night. We didn't have any gear, food. We had nothing. One night we stumbled upon some drunk Russian soldiers. They stared at our uniforms. They grabbed their rifles and were getting ready to shoot us. They thought we were Germans. It was night, it was dark, and we had to try very hard to convince them that we weren't. All 3 of us were crying and sobbing, showing the tattooed numbers on our arms and saying, "Check, check, check." But it's impossible to have a conversation with a drunk, much less a drunken Russian soldier. And it didn't exactly help that this was at night, and we were, after all, dressed as Germans. Somehow, by a miracle, we convinced them. Of course, I went home to look for my parents, and in Pardubice, I realised I was not going to see them again. I lived with a family friend until a Jewish man looked me up, Alfred Eisner. He said to me, "Werner, from now on, I'm going to be your guardian." I literally had no one else in the world. I did nothing but study. After about a year, I moved to Prague. and I lived in the Jewish orphanage on 25 Belgiska Street. I was in charge of the library, and of all the boys I lived with then, I was the only one who remained in the Czech Republic. None of them had any living relatives. They were found homes in every corner of the world. As for me, I left the Jewish faith, because after all that I had seen and gone through, I could not believe in God. I'm an atheist to this day. I never did improve my math skills, but I was good in languages. With a university degree in economics, I went into foreign trade, and in time I married and we had a daughter. I retired several years ago, but I feel I have much to give, and that's why I've been involved with the Terezin Initiative. We carry out research, we meet with historians, and most important for me, I speak with young people so I can tell them about all that I've been through, exactly when I was their age. They really do listen. They ask questions. And hopefully such horrors won't happen again.